Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison. Our speaker today is Annie Laurie Gaylor, who will be talking to us, who is a co-host of a Free Thought Radio program on Air America and the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, talking to us today about politics and religion in reason we trust.
Well, can you hear me?
Yes.
I was going to ask Dan to do one more quick song. And Dan is co-president with me, and this is his new book, Godless, How an Evangelical Preacher Became One of America's Leading Atheists, and it's a foreword by Richard Dawkins, a killer foreword. This discussion of religion and politics by reading a few words, famous words, from 1960. Many of you remember those words. It was John F. Kennedy in his historic speech to the ministers of Houston, where they wanted to be assured that the Vatican would not be running the country if they elected a Catholic. And these are the pertinent words of JFK: "I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no Catholic prelate would tell the president, should he be Catholic, how to act, and no Protestant minister would tell his parishioners for whom to vote, where no church or church school is granted any public funds or political preference, and where no man is denied public office merely because his religion differs from the president who might appoint him or the people who might elect him. I believe in an America that is officially neither Catholic, Protestant, nor Jewish, where no public official either requests or accepts instructions on public policy from the Pope, the National Council of Churches, or any other ecclesiastical source, where no religious body seeks to impose its will directly or indirectly upon the general populace or the public acts of its officials. For while this year it may be a Catholic against whom the finger of suspicion is pointed, in other years it has been and may someday be again a Jew or a Quaker or a Unitarian or a Baptist. It was Virginia's harassment of Baptist preachers, for example, that led to Jefferson's statute of religious freedom. Today I may be the victim, but tomorrow it may be you, until the whole fabric of our harmonious society is ripped apart at a time of great national peril. Finally, I believe in an America where religious intolerance will someday end, where all men," he was pre-feminist, and all churches are treated as equals, where every person has the same right to attend or not to attend the church of his choice, where there is no Catholic vote, no anti-Catholic vote, no block voting of any kind. Now, look how far we have come from those famous words. There is not one political candidate today who could dare utter any part of that speech, except perhaps something about the churches. And I think it shows the degradation that our country has undergone, this idea that we had a treasured principle, a constitutional principle of separation, church and state. And our society used to understand that it was a bedrock of our society, and it was a purely American principle that was the, we were first among nations to adopt this principle and to have a godless and secular constitution. And it used to be something that was revered and taught in schools and treasured. And today it would be a kiss of death for a politician to say the same thing that JFK said in 1960. And I think it is kind of scary to see the ground that we have lost. To give an idea of that kiss of death about religion, anti-religion, pro-separation of church and state and politics, you may have caught what happened last week, Elizabeth Dole, in her race, going after, is it Beth Hagen, running a fabricated ad that said that she was an atheist. And now she's got an anti-defamation lawsuit against her. And the idea that if she were an atheist, this would be the ultimate crime in a politician. It's a little disturbing. And, you know, I think that we have never seen a presidential race, which really started 2 years ago, of this nature, where CNN had its first faith forum, I think it was June 07, and the Democratic presidential candidates were trotted out to answer questions by clergy and by religious members in the audience, and having to wear religion on their sleeve and basically genuflect to the audience and trot out their Christian credentials. And they all did it. And it sort of was all downhill from that point. And then we saw in August Reverend Warren, Rick Warren, at the Saddleback Church holding his political forum for the, you know, Obama and McCain, who felt they had to go, who voluntarily went, but I'm sure they felt there was no choice, to go to this mega church, where this self-appointed minister asked them, you know, very important questions affecting the outcome of the presidential race. And CNN televised it, and it was on over and over again. So I think the media are in complicity with the religious right, who have really been responsible for the agenda of the presidential race. They're calling the shots. We saw McCain talk about how he believed this was a Christian nation, and Belief.net, you may have seen that interview. We saw Obama have to trot out his Christian credentials, partly to dissuade people that he wasn't a Muslim, you know, horrors if he were. But also the faith-based council that he proposed in July was clearly to capitulate to the religious right. And what we've really seen is a religious test for public office. And you know, and I know, that Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution expressly forbids any religious test for public office, but that's what we have. It's a de facto religious test for public office. And I guess that the great concern this fall was the Alliance Defense Fund, which is that Christian-based group in Arizona, and their religious legal eagles. And they have a $40 million annual budget, a lot of it from Focus on the Family. And they've intervened in Freedom from Religion Foundation lawsuits. So far, they've lost, but they have a huge budget. And they, as you know, called the pulpit initiative, telling ministers that they should be endorsing candidates from the pulpit. They want a test case to go before the Supreme Court, which they hope will be altered soon in their favor, and may already be in their pocket. And they want to use tax-exempt ministries to influence elections. And you know that when you write a check to the Prairie Unitarian or to the Freedom from Religion Foundation, for that matter, or any 501c3 or any church, that it is automatically tax exempt. You can deduct it from what you pay in taxes. And the agreement, the gentle person's agreement, is that the charitable entity, which gets that great write-off, gets that great benefit, doesn't pay property taxes, doesn't pay for its fire, does, you know, so often gets more benefits than the rest of us. that they will not engage in partisan politicking. And they are, you know, on the warpath to change that. And I think it's a very, very dangerous trend. You have Texas churches on practically every other corner. You have dominance in our country by the fundamentalists and by Roman Catholics. And if they're telling everybody who to vote for, and they're using tax-exempt dollars to do it, you can see what would happen. It's like money laundering. People can write checks as big as they want to churches and to tax-exempt entities, and if they can turn that tax-exempt donation and use it for politicking, I mean, it's totally corrupting. And it's very obvious how corrupting it would be that, it's vote-buying. And basically, I think that was what was behind Bush's faith-based initiative. It's a way to buy votes from a particular sector. This week, we had a case at the Freedom From Religion Foundation. We're starting to get phone calls and emails about churches with putting signs up in their lawns all around the country. But we had a fascinating call from a man near Colorado Springs, and he played me what was left on his phone answering machine, and it was a robocall. And it was a robocall from Reverend Carmody, and he was a local priest in Colorado Springs. And it was, a two-minute robocall? You can go to our website and hear it if you want, but it was saying that the Catholic Church has always stood for life, and it's always opposed abortion, and McCain is for life, and Obama isn't. And this election is terribly important, and you must get out and vote for life. And by the way, the Archbishop of Denver, Chaput, says this and this. I mean, it's a totally blatant electioneering. And we think also that it's probably a violation of FEC rules, because it's a pre-recorded message that was sent, obviously not just sent to this particular person. It was probably sent all over Colorado. So we'll be making a complaint with the FEC. But the damage is being done. And in Colorado, you not only have very tight races, but you have two referenda that are really the result of the religious right. You have a referenda to declare that life begins at conception, and then you have another one, anti-gay referenda. So to have this call going out, boy, does that have an impact. And let's see. The electioneering is one issue, but another aspect of religion and politics that's of great concern to me and to the Freedom From Religion Foundation is this idea that churches have unbridled freedom in politicking over referenda. And, for example, if you look at Proposition 8 in California, which is supposed to undo the Supreme Court decision there that you could have same-sex marriage, how much money was it?
25 million.
$25 million has come in mostly from denominations around the country, Mormon and Catholic predominantly, but also many of the fundamentalists. It was a referendum that was conjured up in megachurches in San Diego. It's almost exclusively been lobbied for by either churches or religious groups. And when you read the newspaper articles, I mean, this isn't just my summation, this is the reporter saying the same thing. It's a religious lobby that is completely behind all of the anti-gay referenda, which have passed in about 30 states. And when you go to the IRS regulations, and I did in 04 to write a letter of complaint to the IRS commissioner, they allow churches to get involved in referenda. They do not consider referenda to be political. And this is a joke, because they say that churches are not supposed to engage in lobbying that would affect the enactment of a law. So if it's a legislative law, a bill, they're not supposed to lobby inordinately. But this is affecting the statutes. This is going to be amending the state constitution. And so it's hands off. They say that they can lobby as much as they want to their congregations. They can put it in the church bulletin. They can preach from the pulpit, and that's where you get people like the bishop in Madison writing a letter that he's making all the priests read. That's how our anti-gay referendum got passed here in Wisconsin 2 years ago. That was going on all over the state. But that they can, it's pretty much, they can do what they want. Now, if they want to reach the members of the public, every state law is different, and you have a state election board, and if you spend a certain minimum, you may have to register with the state election board, but the penalties for not doing so are a risk slap. So, you know, how do you fight? This is an unfair battle. $25 million has been raised on the other side against Proposition 8, but it's not, for the most part, tax-exempt entities. You know, it's unions and Apple Corporation and Hollywood and a few liberal churches. But it's an unfair battle when all that money, all that tax-exempt money can be used for this political purpose. And I see this as a very major problem. And when I wrote the IRS about this 2 years ago, I got back a "we're not budging" letter. And I think there needs to be a real public outcry over this, because all of our state constitutions are going to be amended before this is over to ban gay marriage, and it's all with the religious lobby. And as you know, we're facing anti-abortion, not just in Colorado, but in South Dakota, once again. And that's a real narrow battle where they're trying to ban abortion in South Dakota as another test case to go before the Supreme Court. So what a weapon in the hands of these churches. And let's see. So then I thought I would like to just talk a little bit about what the Freedom From Religion Foundation is up to. We didn't bring a whole lot of issues up, but we do have some stuff here. This is Free Thought Today, which I've been editing since 85. And this is a picture of a billboard that we put up in Denver. It's red, white, and blue, keep religion out of politics. And we also did a mobile billboard at the Republican National Convention. We hit both of the conventions with this message. We have a big billboard up in Des Moines that the candidates all had to drive by. It was on the way from the airport, so I imagine Obama saw it
yesterday.
But I think we also need to get God out of government. We take lawsuits, and we have lawsuits in court at any given time. Our most recent lawsuit didn't get a lot of publicity locally, but we're suing Governor Doyle. We're not picking on him. It's just because it was easy to sue him. We're going after the National Day of Prayer proclamations that are enacted by all of the governors. And it's hard to go after symbolic violations like the National Day of Prayer that was enacted in 52, and it became a floating holiday. It was a floating holiday until Reagan in 88 made it the first Thursday of every May. And as you may know, all of the governors are pressured by the National Day of Prayer Task Force to issue proclamations. And that task force is headed by Shirley Dobson, who's the wife of James Dobson, who's focused on the family in Colorado Springs. And they choose the theme, they choose a Bible verse, and they choose a scriptural theme, and they write the proclamation. And in 08, George Bush issued the proclamation verbatim. It was the one that was written by Shirley Dobson's task force. And the governors pick up parts or all of it, and about 30 or so governors issued the exact same theme and Bible verse, and Governor Doyle was among them. It was quite a religious proclamation. I'm not sure he even read it, knew what he signed it. And the funny thing about the proclamation that Doyle gave in 08 was that it was actually the National Day of Prayer Task Force template from 07. So we have to go back and see whether he just issued the same proclamation 2 years in a row by mistake, or he's just a year behind. But what our lawsuit is saying is that the government is now working hand in glove with this very proselytizing organization, and that it's the proclamation itself and the partnership between Focus on the Family's National Day of Prayer Task Force and the government that we are suing over. So we are suing President Bush, we are suing Governor Doyle, and then next week after the election, we'll be filing a lawsuit in Colorado suing Governor Ritter there, because that's sort of the home of the National Day of Prayer Task Force. And this is sort of a sidelight from what we've been doing. We've been mostly focusing on the faith-based initiative and have taken and won about 10 lawsuits. But as you may be aware, we had a rebuff from the Supreme Court last year, and they denied the right of taxpayers to sue over the formation of the faith-based initiative internal bureaucracy in the White House. We sued over the actual creation. Dan and I were co-plaintiffs, along with my mother, Ann Gaylor, and we sued over the actual office in the White House and at the cabinet and said, you know, this is, goes beyond the power of the president, and it was funded by Congress, and therefore we had the right to sue. And the Supreme Court, 5-4, voted against us. And when we started that lawsuit, we had Sandra Day O'Connor still on the court, and then, of course, she was replaced by Alito, and that was kind of our downfall. We were winning. We had just been reinstated with plaintiffs standing by the Seventh Circuit, and then the Bush administration sued and took it to the Supreme Court, and the die was cast probably at that point. We held out a little bit of hope, even after the oral arguments, which didn't go so well. But our decision came down the very last day that they issued decisions, and by then, you know what this court was doing a year ago. I think there was one good decision. It was just a string of horrors. So we knew by the end of June that we were in for on that one, and that was a very bad case. But they did not actually overturn the precedent of Flast versus Cohen, which is the Supreme Court decision from the 60s that says that taxpayers can sue over acts of Congress that violate the separation of church and state. So although Kennedy was the turncoat, he sort of betrayed us, he was firm that he did not want that precedent overturned, or they would have gone that far if they'd gotten his vote. So we have a very hostile Supreme Court, and we are licking our wounds over what this means for our lawsuits. We've had a string of lawsuits thrown out since Hine versus the Freedom from Religion Foundation. But we are going back to court. We have a very important lawsuit in North Dakota. And we filed that a year ago, and it involves the North Dakota Boys and Girls Ranch, which is run by the Lutheran Church and the ELA?
Evangelical
Lutherans. There's two Lutheran denominations that for more than probably a century, but at least 50 years, have been in charge of the juvenile delinquency program in North Dakota. And they run these ranches, and they have Christian worship, and they have Bible study. It's mandatory. If you don't participate, you get locked down in your room. You can be held longer. You have punishment, isolation. They have explicit rules that you cannot engage in worship other than Christian worship, and they explicitly mention the smudging of the sweet grass. Does anybody here know what that means? It's a Native American worship. And so this is a legacy of the missionizing of the Native Americans in North Dakota, where they would, you know, take them out of the homes and put them in missionary facilities. And they're still doing it. I mean, there are white kids going there too, but we took this as a taxpayer lawsuit a year ago and weren't thrown out until this year, but then they said the Hine decision meant the taxpayers could not sue. And we thought about appealing, but instead we have found injured parties, and our attorney just flew to North Dakota this week, a Native American mother who had PKU, if you know what that is, as a baby, and it's caused some problems for her. You know, she needs other people to read her mail and help her. Well, she has an autistic son, and guess what? They took him, and they put him in the Boys and Girls Ranch against his wishes and against her wishes, where they are not giving him proper treatment for autism. They're treating him like a juvenile delinquent who needs Christianity. So we are, our attorney just flew to North Dakota, where she has a friend who has been doing all of the negotiations with us, and they were meeting, and hopefully we'll refile that with her as a very brave plaintiff, willing to be identified and willing to have her son identified. But it's very hard because he just turned 17, and so we're not quite sure. We can file the lawsuit this year, but when he turns 18, probably it won't be thrown out, but it could be declared moot. So it makes it a lot harder when you have to find the injured parties, and usually they don't want to sue. We've had all kinds of people contact us from North Dakota who have kids or had kids in the Boys and Girls Ranch, but they're afraid to go public. They don't want any more retribution against their children. And there are horror stories. One of the taxpayer plaintiffs that we did have had a child taken away from their family, and she had drug abuse problems. And originally they thought it was okay, and then they realized what was going on, and she was getting locked down for religious reasons. And they tried to get her out, and they couldn't. And they cut off the ability of the parents to see her. And when she turned 18, they said, "Where do you want to go?" And she said, "San Francisco." And they gave her a ticket, and they haven't seen her since. So it's just sort of horror stories. And so we really hope that we'll be able to go back to federal court in the next couple of weeks and try to remedy this really systemic problem that is fully funded by taxpayers. And they know the money is going for these programs, but because the legislature isn't specifically saying you can only contract with these churches, courts are saying that we don't have that taxpayer standing because it's not directly required by the legislature to work with these churches. I think it's a bogus argument by the court. But and then we are looking at the Veterans Administration, where we also had an important lawsuit with taxpayer standing. And that is where, at all levels, but it depends on every clinic you go to and the hospital is different, you have a spiritual inventory that is required, and it's considered as important as your physical. And so people who have been plugged in for a while don't go through this, but if you haven't seen your doctor for a while, for example, I got a call from a man in Madison, and he was really upset. And he said, this was after we filed the lawsuit, he said that he wanted to get a referral for an optician. He needed new eyeglasses. And they said, well, we haven't seen you for a while. You haven't been in the system. First you have to come in and get a physical, and then you have to get a spiritual inventory for an eyeglass referral.
In Madison.
Well, he called, and he wanted me to go with him and be his representative. Our attorney said, no, you can't do that. But it turned out that he contacted one of the, I guess they have social workers at the hospital, and the hospital said, if you don't want to take the spiritual inventory, you don't have to. So he got out of it, and actually that's the way it works. The VA doesn't tell anybody this. They give you the spiritual inventory, and they read you this thing and say, for holistic reasons, you know, we believe that it is important for you to answer these questions. But they don't say, if you don't want to, you have the right to refuse. You have to openly say, no, I don't want to. And so this is going on all over the country. And I think that we finally have found ourselves, we were thrown out of court on taxpayer standing, and I think we finally have found a plaintiff in Pennsylvania where he had three separate hospitalizations and he had the whole gamut of spiritual inventories. He's a member of our group. He's a free thinker. And he had chaplains preaching at him all the time during his hospital stays. And so we're hoping, if not this particular patient, will find another one. But it makes it a lot harder to sue in the overall way that we were doing before, because there was a number of other problems with the VA. And so it depends on the individual experiences. But we are not giving up on any of these abuses. And we're also looking at some things going on in prison, where they're run by arch-right-wing evangelical groups. We had a case that was thrown out in New Mexico where the women were being subjected to Christian dominionist propaganda that taught that God's on top and man's below him and woman's below him. I mean, they actually have, like, you can see the charts that they give the women, these flow charts. And then they also have this series of questions and answers, and they would say, you must obey civil authority as well as godly authority. And then there's a question that says, what if the civil authority is corrupt? Do I have to obey that? And in great big capital letters, yes. I mean, it's really, really out there stuff. It's, who's that guy?
Bill Gothard
in Illinois, who is rather notorious even among evangelicals. Bill Gothard. And he's one of these big 40 assets guys, where they we have another lawsuit going on with the Lutheran Brotherhood, and where they have these assets that they have secular sounds, but then they're all based on biblical precepts. And so there's all these assets that they're training the prisoners to memorize, and they all have religious components. Well, we got thrown out of court in New Mexico on taxpayer standing, but we're looking at a case in Arizona where Alaska prisoners, most of them lifers, are being subjected to this and wanting our help. So we hope to be able to go and revisit these injustices with another kind of plaintiff. So there's no shortage of state church violations going on, let me tell you. And we just hired our first staff attorney at the Freedom from Religion Foundation, a new law graduate, and she's very busy. And the Freedom From Religion Foundation started in 1976, and it was myself, my mother, and a gentleman, elderly gentleman, who had died within a year. And now we are almost 13,000 members nationwide. And we have grown a great deal in the last couple of years. And that Supreme Court case wasn't good for the Constitution, but it actually was pretty good for the growth of our group. Got a lot of publicity and sympathy. And then what else are we doing, Dan?
Cherry Creek? Oh, you mentioned that.
Yeah. So anyway, if I think that that's probably covers it. You all know how much religion there's been in politics. I was preaching to the choir here.
I've been doing quite a bit of reading about, there was a book by the Unitarian minister, Forrest Church, about the Holy God, about the first founding fathers, and their relationship to this touchy problem, which seemed pretty clear-cut at the time. But the point is that at that time, the churches, especially the Baptist and Presbyterian churches, were totally behind the separation of church and state. And I wonder if your organization has been successful in eliciting cooperation from particularly the mainline Protestant religions, and even the Catholics too, they don't want.
Well, yeah,
they don't want these fundamentalists in charge.
Yeah, actually, for the first time ever, I was invited to speak to a Catholic congregation, Blessed Sacrament adult education class. And that was last January, and the priest introduced me by saying, "Well, I got the good news that this is the biggest turnout we've ever had. And the bad news is this is because there's an atheist speaker." But I gave a very diplomatic talk to that church, and I was able to go through a lot of state church litigation that was brought by Catholics. And for example, in Wisconsin, 1890, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, said no more Bible reading and instruction in the public schools. And that was a case brought by Catholics and students and their parents because they were reading the Protestant version of the Bible. And so they said, let's just get rid of the whole problem. And even right through one of the more recent school prayer cases was brought by Catholics, Doe versus Santa Fe, Texas, where you couldn't have student-initiated or student-led prayer at football games and over the intercom. And that was brought by Mormon and Catholic students because they were Southern Baptist prayers. At the Freedom From Religion Foundation, we have had plaintiffs of every belief, diverse belief. Most recently in Green Bay, we had a lawsuit going about a nativity scene that was put at the entrance of City Hall. And it looks like we've won the case, so the judge declared it moot. But we had people calling our office and begging us last December to go to court. And we signed up. We didn't get a Catholic for some reason, but we had Lutheran, Presbyterian, Wiccan, Unitarian, and Freethinker.
Taku Ronsman?
Yes.
Was a member of this congregation before she moved to Green Bay.
Oh, okay. Yes, Taku was really our lead plaintiff.
Oh, yes.
and been very ill, and this has been very stressful for her, what the city has done to her. And she's just been a kind of gruesome cancer treatments, and so this has been very stressful for her, but she has been our main plaintiff there. And
the cross, the same thing happened.
In the cross, the Ten Commandments, we had taken a case, and we had two members of our group, and they wouldn't let us keep the names anonymous, and then the man died very suddenly, and the widow was totally bereaved and shocked, and she said, "I don't want my name to be the only name on the legal caption." So we went to the media and said, "We need more plaintiffs," because we had written all our members in the area. No one had also come forward. We had Catholic, Lutheran, Protestant, Jewish, Unitarian. We had 21 people respond. And it was really heartwarming. I was thrilled that that many people from that many diverse religions not only were willing to be aligned with the Freedom From Religion Foundation, but they got it. They understood the separation of church and state issue. And I would point out that there was Catholic sympathy because it was a Protestant version of the Ten Commandments. You know, there's two different versions, and the Catholic version leaves out the part about graven images. So it's divisive in the community. And then we also took another case with Reverend Wolfe.
Yeah, here in Madison. Mary Savers.
Yeah, that was in the late 90s, and he's Is he UCC? No, he's...
Plymouth Congregational.
Plymouth Congregational, which is one of the most liberal.
It's on Atwood Avenue.
What?
Atwood Avenue?
Yeah.
And he was very concerned because it was a law passed by Jensen in the budget with no sunlight, and it was to give $50,000 to have somebody coordinate members of the clergy on marriage counseling. And so we went to court, and we needed very much to have a minister, and we went to everybody, and he was the one who came forward. And his motivation was partly that he wants to be able to preside at gay weddings. And he certainly did not want to have the religious right dictating to him marriage counseling. And what kind of... If you didn't do this marriage counseling, then the ministers wouldn't marry you at their church, basically, was the upshot of it. And we won that case. Unfortunately, we won that before Judge Shabazz. It was an appeal, but he didn't publish it. And that makes it harder to cite, but it was a firm victory. And we loved winning one against Jensen.
Do you ever have any communication with Morris Dees of Southern Poverty?
We invited him to speak, and boy, his speaking fee was too high. It wasn't a poverty speaking fee. But our Alabama chapter has worked with him quite a bit, and they like him.
When Moses got down from the mountain and saw the golden calf and broke the tablets, and he went back and got new tablets, was it written in his mind added at that point? The original version didn't have it.
Actually, the original one did have graven images, but that was not on tablets, it was spoken. But the second batch, which was the first tablets, did not have graven. How can you have a commandment against graven images on a graven image? And there was a third one, you know, he broke the first one, so the third one came back totally different. It had all these weird rules about you can't boil a goat in the milk of its mother.
You can't see the kid in its mother's mouth.
You know?
Which is like Orthodox
Hebrew.
Well,
that's not in the Ten Commandments, but it's in
Yeah, it is. It's in the Ten Commandments.
There's three versions of the Ten Commandments in the Bible, and this is the version that actually says it's the Ten Commandments. So it's all very confusing.
And that's good, because I've been tempted to boil a goat.
Fight it.
I'm kind of alarmed to see that there's talk every now and then about somebody in the health industry being able to refuse treatment to a woman having to do with abortion. How can they do that with their Hippocratic oaths?
Yes. I think if someone is going to be in a medical profession where, for example, there's services like vasectomies or abortions or tubal ligations, they should choose a different line than obstetrics or gynecology or, you know, whatever.
If they get that line, if they choose that line, they should be able
right.
to carry out.
I agree. And there have been some litigation in Wisconsin and where pharmacists have been... a pharmacist sued because he lost his job because he wouldn't refer. And it was not just that he wouldn't refer a woman on. He kept the prescription for birth control. You remember that? And I think it's still wending its way to the state Supreme Court. But at the appeals level, he lost in state court. But that is a really vicious thing that he did.
Yeah.
And I think they just passed some law in the UK where they've made it solid that you can't do things like that. But we have ways to go in this country on that.
How in the world can those ranches kidnap a child?
Well, it's completely with the authority of the state. They are the detention homes for children once they get into the state system. And so it's the social workers and the cops and the DA and everything. They're sentencing the children for juvenile delinquency to go to these ranches, often against parental wish. So they're severing the parental rights because they get into the criminal justice system.
What about that autistic child?
Yeah, I don't know yet. Our attorney's finding out what it is he did. But yes, it's a terrible travesty.
It's kidnapping.
Well, I think it is.
There's some precedents in Australia, which, you know, was populated by convicts. And if the government of Australia wrote home and said, we don't have enough carpenters, they just make sure they got some convicted carpenters, and then so they got a proper mix. of professions in Australia.
But I think even Wisconsin still has correction facilities for juveniles. The difference in North Dakota is that the correctional facilities are all being run by this church.
Oh.
And then they're making religion part of it.
I have another question. Why in the world do we have a chaplain for conks?
That started early. But when it started, they were actually meeting in New York State for some reason briefly. And I think the idea was someone needed to travel with them because they were away from home. But when they went back to D.C., you know, it just stuck with them. And James Madison went along with it when it first started, but then he wrote, I don't think it was Memorial Remonstrance, but he wrote something after that, the detached memoranda in his older age, where he was very firmly against the chaplaincies. But it's been going on a long time. We'd love to be able to sue it, but it's one of those cases that's very hard to sue. You'd almost need a member of Congress to sue over it.
How about Pete Stark?
Well, yeah, you know, I'm just thinking we should ask him. But
to Congress, if you don't go around touting Christian credentials.
Michael Newdow did take a case against it, but then it didn't get anywhere and got taken out of court. You know, he's the Pledge of Allegiance guy, and we're working with him on a case in New Hampshire. He's waiting the Ninth Circuit. He's got another case where he won it in California, saying that under God doesn't belong in the pledge. And the Ninth Circuit's been sitting on it since January, so we're waiting to see what will happen. But he's a very persistent guy, and maybe we can come up with a way to sue. But a Heim decision is going to make it even harder to get after some of these symbolic violations.
I have a question about how you go about choosing what to pursue. I guess in my opinion there are some great evils and some lesser evils in the violation of church and state. And I'm just wondering, sometimes I see in the paper a lawsuit that the Freedom From Religion Foundation has pursued, like the situation in Green Bay, where a municipality has chosen to put up some religious symbol, usually Christian. I'm just wondering whether those sorts of cases can actually alienate people, whereas some of the greater, what I consider the greater evils, like what you started out sharing with us about this nonprofit situation and how just millions of dollars are being funneled into programs that are mostly Christian in origin, and it's really kind of behind the scenes and nefarious in our government. I'm just wondering how you choose, because it seems like one is a tremendous evil, and one is kind
to
of a
the people
smaller.
In Green Bay. To the, I mean, I'm not exaggerating. We had people phoning us daily. This was the very end of the year when our attorney wasn't even in town. Half of our staff was gone. I'm taking the phone calls. People begging us to sue. This divided their community. The Green Bay Press Gazette has issued editorial after editorial condemning the actions of Chad Fredette and never really quite praising the Freedom From Religion Foundation, but agreeing with us. And to tell people what happened with that, where was it you? Where did you sue? I mean, where did you write the first letter?
A little town north of Green Bay.
Peshtigo. We get complaints from members of the public about nativity scenes in public places. And there are two court decisions, and they're kind of lousy, but you can't have a nativity scene on government property by itself. And in the 70s, there was a very, or 84, there was a very bad decision called, what was it called? Lynch versus Donnelly in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, which was very unusual circumstances where it was like a private park, but the city had religious displays, and there was a miniature nativity scene in the middle of it. And the Supreme Court looked at that and said, oh, that's okay, because it's in the context of a secular display.
Oh, it was small.
Yes. Well, so that decision has spawned this huge apologetics for having nativity scenes there. The entire, you know, they're huge. They've been there for 50 years all by themselves. They stick up a few secular trimmings like reindeer, and then they can conform to Pawtucket. But at least we can complain when they don't have something else up. And so I was being besieged, so I asked Dan to write a letter to Peshtigo. And so he did. And it got written up somewhere. And Chad Fredette, who's the president of Green Bay City Council at that time, he's now running for Congress, and I hope he loses, he said, oh, well, let's, you know, what did he say? It was very insulting.
Like, pick on somebody your own size, something like that.
Yeah, and so I'm going to give them something to complain about. And I was going to put this nativity scene on my lawn, but now I'm going to put it at the entrance of City Hall. This is on top of City Hall where everybody has to go under, regardless of your views, religious or not. It's what you can see from the street. One of our plaintiffs was a Lutheran who was a delivery person who had to drive by there every single day. And he called us and wanted to be a plaintiff. This was so offensive. When they did this sort of, it was a committee vote and it was up the next day, then they said, well, other people came forward. Wiccans, Taku, a Buddhist. They said, we want to put up our own stuff. And they let Taku put hers up briefly, and then it was vandalized. And she spent $100 on the display and was very bitter about it. And then they said, we're going to have a moratorium, except the nativity scene can stay up. And this, the community was really outraged. I mean, they wanted us to sue. There's no question that most people in the community felt that was horrible. That was just grandstanding because he wanted to run for Congress. And the mayor supported him, but now the mayor has backed down. And the mayor has, they're voting on Wednesday on his proposal that they should only have secular displays up. So I felt that, I mean, that was one of our more popular, locally popular cases. And besides which, the Supreme Court ruled in 1989 that it was a case in Pittsburgh where they had a huge nativity scene on the entrance of the building. Then they had a lighted Christmas tree and a menorah behind it. And the Supreme Court ruled that you could keep the Christmas tree with the menorah because that symbolized diversity, but you could not put a nativity scene at the entrance of a core government building. So we are enforcing the Supreme Court's ruling. What else could we do? You can't put a nativity scene at the core entrance of a government building according to the Supreme Court. So we were right, and they were really wrong. So I think that one we had no choice. Mm-hmm. We, you know, I had making frantic phone calls to our attorney. We were working with another law firm, and then they had a conflict of interest. So we scrambled to get that lawsuit filed, and that one felt like an imperative.
Yeah. I guess the reason I asked my question is because it's not a matter of right or wrong. I definitely agree that what you did was right. It's just a matter of where the money should go.
Well,
that's really where what I was wondering.
But things slip. It's the beginning of the slippery slope, mm-hmm. and letting what seemed to be littler things go, and then letting a few more go, and the next thing you know, we're where we are now, which is where you started out today, Annie Laurie, with all this money being laundered through churches to go to the political campaign. You know,
well,
one thing leads to another.
Right, that's the ultimate that could happen, yeah. I think, if the IRS was to change its rules. But that's what's going on with the referendum.
It's erosion, though. Mm-hmm. And
that was, I can't feel any regret over taking that case. If we hadn't taken it, well, we're waiting for the final decision. We may have to go back to court to enforce it. But if we hadn't, the mayor would never have proposed that what he did, that we should have a secular decoration. And besides, we couldn't abandon these people calling us up from every religion asking us to sue.
Anyway, I'm wondering if that gets the press. All those nativity scene things, they're mm-hmm. big, big wads of many column inches. But I didn't know about how much was going on. I didn't know about, where is it, which Dakota?
North Dakota, sorry.
North, okay. I didn't know about that. That doesn't get the press, but for some reason, the nativity scene thing does.
Of course, that was Wisconsin, and when we file suit in another state, it's really hard to get local press on that. And
right.
Now that we've gone down to one newspaper town,
yeah.
Even harder.
It's rough, and I have a feeling that a vast majority of the public, they might know your name now because of those nativity things, but I doubt that they know about
Well, remember, she did say that the membership has been growing steadily in the last couple of years, so more and more people are getting aware of what the hell is going on.
I would hope so, but 13,000, and I'm one of the proud members, is just not enough. And I don't know what else you can do to make you. And I'm talking about the folks that go to church and number of people in various churches are upset.
Oh, it's really changed. I mean, yeah, to have that kind of
response.
That's
very good news. Most everything else you said always out there.
Yeah, well, I think the politicians are behind the times more than even the population. They're so scared of the religious right. They're, you know, so apologetic, and the Democrats, you know, have been told by the Republicans for years now, you're going to lose the values voters, and you know, it's.
Yeah.
I think that they should be more concerned at this point about wooing the secular vote. The demographics are 14 to 16% of the adult population are non-religious. That's the term they use in one way or another, which would include not just atheists and agnostics. And a lot of Unitarians, but just people who they just say we're not religious. And that's American Religious Identification Survey, which is definitive. It's more than 60,000 people who are surveyed by City University of New York. And there's probably another survey coming out in a couple of years. The last one came out in 01. And then the Pew Forum has come up with the 16%. And then also, one out of every four non-religious is non-religious in the 15 to 24 age range. So the demographics are changing really rapidly, but it hasn't caught up with politicians. And they still think, I got a pander to be elected.
Yeah.
And they got all those gotcha issues that they're worrying about. So I'm hoping that it'll filter into politics soon.
I have to wonder, too, in the demographics, how many people who say, well, my family was raised Catholic, therefore I'm Catholic, even though I don't do anything about it. I would put them in the non-religious category as well, and that's got to be a huge number, I would think.
Well, ARIS, the American Religious Identification Survey, what was it, 1990 did it come out? It was 9% non-religious and 80-something percent Christian, and when it came out in 01, it was 14% non-religious and had gone down to 70-something Christian. So there's been a rapid change.
But even within the group that says
they're
Christian, doesn't
how many
mean that they're really Christian?
Most of them.
As far as,
well, the problem is you got to make them think about it. I was attending the Humanist Convention in June, and Pete Starks was talking, and he didn't realize he was a humanist until the humanist group sent off a big questionnaire for him to answer, and he was going, yes, 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 and then basically had to call himself a humanist. So,
why can't
the trick is also getting people to know these things.
Why can't the government be sued for breaking the Constitution?
Well, I mean, that's what
Congress that's the basic problem.
But
really.
Congress is.
You have to, because they make it as hard as possible, and you have to show standing that you're harmed by that action.
Even if the law?
No.
Well, if it's a law that Congress funds,
separate?
Then you might be able to sue over it, but if it's just general funding, like the faith-based offices, where Bush was using his discretionary money for the White House to set up that office, we've been told we can't sue.
Even though that's against the law.
Well, even though it's against the Constitution, in our opinion, but we had the Supreme Court 5-4 saying you don't have standing to sue. Because Dan and I don't have standing to sue, nobody has standing to sue. I mean, it wasn't just our rights to sue, it was the whole rights of the American population. To ask for some accountability on this.
Yes, do you think there's going to be any way to challenge the taxpayer standing? No taxpayer standing rule?
Not for a while. I mean, somebody else is going to have to leave the court who's bad and be replaced by somebody who's good. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it takes a while. Our advocate at the oral arguments was Breyer, and he's had some bad votes on state church. I think he's waking up. Well, he cited in the Texas case over the Ten Commandments on Capitol grounds, the Supreme Court a couple of years ago, that's okay, but you can't have it inside. In Kentucky, they had twin cases, and it was in a courthouse. You can't have it inside a courthouse. And Breyer voted with Kentucky, can't have it in the courthouse, and then he said, but it's okay to have it on the lawn of your core government building in Texas. I was really mad at him. But I think he's regretting that. But you know, even if Obama hopefully gets in, we're going to have to watch very carefully who he appoints to the Supreme Court on this issue.
Because he said he's going
to. This is a slightly minor note. I'm on the school board, and a gentleman burst into a closed meeting and superintendent said this was a closed meeting, so then he went out to talk to the guy afterwards, and I said, well, what did the guy have on his mind? And he said, well, he's a fundamentalist Christian, and he said, if they're not letting the kids have any Christian symbolism at Christmas, what's all this stuff about Halloween? I don't know how the superintendent Whoops. Asked him that. He said, I, yeah, we still, my office sometime and we'll talk about
we still hear that. Yeah, that's really
do
weird.
Do you work closely with Americans United for the Separation of Church and State?
Well, not closely, but in communication, and they wrote a very good Friends of the Court brief with ACLU for Hine, and they've done some other Friends of the Court briefs and vice versa. And they used to be Protestants United for Separation of Church and State.
Isn't that Protestants and Other Americans?
And Other Americans United. And they formed really to fight parochial education in the 40s. And their core funding groups include Baptists, the Joint Baptist Committee, that also signed a Friend of the Court brief, but they're a little leery, I think, of getting a little too close to atheist agnostic group. They don't want to alienate funding.
Well, that's part of the point, though, that I was making, that you have the cooperation of these groups who really don't want the government involved in the church, because it's not good for the church or the government.
Right, exactly.
And their cooperation is essential in some of these lawsuits, I think.
What about the recent candidate endorsements from the pulpit? Have there been a number of, has any case been filed?
Well, the people who endorsed from the pulpit pretty much are tuning themselves in because they want to test the case.
Right.
And then the IRS never says anything for months. And when we make a complaint about a church doing politicking, we get a form letter back, and that's it. And then, you know, maybe 2 years down the road, you might read, they might have a general response on things they've investigated. They're, you know, a power into themselves. They're not accountable to the person who complains. But we, you know, we're going to be complaining about that priest with that robocall to the IRS, but the attorney advice right now is it looks like the FEC would have more power to go after it because it was electioneering, and it would have been so many households getting the same call.
Were cases of this in Wisconsin that you know of endorsements from the pulpit?
Yeah, the guy. Yeah.
There's someone
there's
north.
A guy up in by.
Near Ellsworth or something.
By Milwaukee.
West Bend?
Yeah, that guy in West Bend, what's his name? Yeah. And he made a big public display of saying, our church is going to all, we're all going to vote for McCain, we're going to vote for the righteous person. And he wants the IRS.
Yeah, they're going to turn themselves
they want
in.
The IRS to come after them, which we hope they do. See how they like not having a tax exemption for a while.
But you know, if they were to lose their tax exemption, and of course, then they want to sue. But if they were, it's just for the year. Then they get to go back into the good graces, you know. It's not like this irreparable thing that even happens to them.
But does it make any difference if, I mean, it's one thing if a priest or minister gets up on Sunday and says, this is a letter from the local head of our denomination, and it says we want you to do this, so do it. It's another thing when they tell a legislator that he will be excommunicated if he votes for the wrong person.
Yes, I mean,
I think
they're crossing
slant.
The line, and that's a whole other issue. But I don't. The IRS hasn't touched that.
Yeah, and it's been published. I mean, it's not like it was just, you know, this is what's going to happen.
Every election they do it. And I don't know if you remember when Bush was running for re-election, he went to the Vatican. He flew to the Vatican asking then Pope John Paul II to enlist his, you know, henchmen, I guess, at the Catholic bishops to do more to help him get elected. I mean, it was overt. Thinking of the words of John F. Kennedy, he didn't even have to be Catholic. He just wanted the Catholic vote.
Now, does it make any difference? I suppose this is a rational thing, and rationality isn't what's at stake here. But does it make any difference if you point out what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander? Today you may be trying to get one might be trying to get his or her religious right person in power, but if you make rules that permit that, you're also making rules that permit people of any other denomination to do that. Suppose it's Muslim tomorrow, how happy would you be?
Well, yeah, maybe people in Dearborn, Michigan might be getting a big dose of the
But does it
the
does that argument faze them, or is it one that just doesn't reach them?
Well, I mean, it didn't even faze them in Hine versus Freedom from Religion that could be turned against
yeah,
the religious groups, because if you had another case where the government was doing something against the wishes of the religious groups, they wouldn't have taxpayers standing to sue either. But at this point, they think they're on top. So, no, I don't think they're that thoughtful.
It's the rationality or irrationality part that bothers me. I mean, it's prevailing in this current election so much.
I think that it's gone so overboard that the public has woken up. I mean, I think it makes most people very uncomfortable to have too much religion being discussed as part of a political race. I mean, you're used to maybe getting the statistics, this person's married and has two kids and they're a Protestant or whatever, but you're not used to this kind of wearing religion on your sleeves all the time and having it be this integral part of your campaigning. And it's just that I think that once Saddleback happened, that debate in Saddleback, it's created a precedent. And the other churches, the mega churches, will want to get in on the act, and it will be very hard to stop. Very distressing.
I was going to ask about Bishop Molino. He's involved through the government, some committee, some group that sends soldiers into South America.
Oh, yeah, that school. School of the Americas or whatever.
And many have been killing women leaders and so on. And we hear all these things, and the public really doesn't know enough about this. And I wonder why religion or other organization just speaking up, and how can a religious leader who's not taxed, does he get a salary from this, or what's going on there? And I wonder why this isn't exposed, because we do have serious problems in Latin America.
Well, I guess that's not... I'm watching it like you are. It's not. I'm not sure what we can do about it as the Freedom from Religion Foundation, but I think it's a scandal.
We can keep religion out of the politics.
I mean, there's been quite a bit of dissension in the Catholic ranks in Madison. You know, there's both sets of ads, and there's been a lot of criticism. I think that criticism needs to come from those Catholics who are giving money to the church, and that's where it's going to really hurt him. I mean, we haven't seen any. We didn't see any movement on the pedophile scale until it really, really hurt them financially. So I think they're the people who need to speak out.
There are a number who got up and walked out when those letters were being read. I know people who were there and saw them. I know one who said, "I wish I had the courage to do that."
Yeah, that letter 2 years ago. Very offensive. Well, actually, and didn't he give a tape? It was a tape recording of himself reading the letter, wasn't it?
Was it?
I think so.
Whichever it was, I remember.
Very unctuous.
Blessed Sacrament, this is the same church you mentioned, who are pretty broad-thinking in many ways, I think. You mentioned the women's group, I think, that invited you to speak.
Adult Education.
Right.
But it was actually the pastor of the church inviting me.
But you know, when they get
a... This is a government committee. Organization that's sanctioned by our government.
And there's probably, well, having a priest on the committee is not technically a violation. Maybe a violation of his ethics to get involved. But I don't think there's a lawsuit there.
If he's not paid?
If he's just. Not, that's
well,
what
even if he is?
But he might be a consultant, they would say. Or
get around it, I suppose.
To me, it's the height of hypocrisy for these so-called pro-life people to worry about an embryo being a murderer of a baby. And they're perfectly all right with war and killing in Iraq and being soldiers and all of that. It just makes no sense.
I have a question in relation to this. The use of the values voters to gain votes for the far-right political planners, the far-right financiers, the defense industry, the oil industry, etc. What I get a lot of information through various sources about the connections between these three. The religion, the money, and the political planning. But what efforts are being made to reach the voters within of the values groups? to inform them as to who's manipulating their votes and why.
I don't know
much about that, and I don't see efforts being made. I mean, I'm miles away from the Baptist kid in a Sunday school I used to be, and with a group of people who could very well have been manipulated in that way. And I don't see efforts being made to reach that population other than through the people that are manipulating them. Mm. Who's reaching out to say, look, if you are a Hispanic voter and you're hooking into these values manipulations, what does that mean for you if your candidate is elected? What does that mean for your in terms of, you know, what's going to happen to your house? What's going to happen to your family?
I mean, the Democratic Party has been trying to reach out to some of those, you know, and they're doing quite well with the Hispanic, actually, some of those likely Republican voters. I mean, that's kind of their job. But I don't know of any actual concerted attempt to reach them. I mean, that's beyond our purview because we're a 501c3.
Well, sure.
So we are scrupulous.
And I'm not implying, you know, that would be your role. But I just
hopefully it'll
circulate. I see people trying to reach it from a political standpoint, but to what center? This is the group that is, for example, this is the person that got to John McCain to elicit his support for Sarah Palin. I mean, where did that come from? She didn't drop out of nowhere. Richard Land, among other people, was one of the ones who, Richard Land, who's a high from the Southern Baptist Church, he was one of the ones, he says, indeed, he was the person, and he's probably not the only one, who proposed Palin, or who was supporting Palin. And so why? You know, the people that are actually cheering for her, they just don't know the hands that were behind it. They see a pretty face, they see someone that fires up the base, and I just don't see that there's a connection at all. And I don't see a massive effort to educate people who are being manipulated.
Well, there has been a massive effort in terms of books coming out. I mean, not necessarily books that that base would read, but it does eventually percolate down. I mean,
yeah,
Dan's book is joining the list, and The God Delusion, yes, and Christopher Hitchens, and we've never seen anything like that in popular culture before in the United States, where atheism and agnosticism are practically chic and trendy for a while, and that's kind of fun. And that does open things up. It's kind of like the gay movement. I mean, we're still kind of back in the closet, but it's starting to open up. And look at where the gay movement has gone from the 1970s to today. I mean, it's amazing. And it's not just, well, the laws might be turning a little hostile, but the social acceptance. But there was a study by the University of Minnesota released in 2006, and it compared social acceptance of out groups. And it was including African American, Arab, Muslim, gay, an atheist.
We're at the bottom.
And atheist is still at the bottom. And they were looking at, they've been doing these studies since the 1960s, and, you know, African-American was way down there, and gay, of course. And there's been huge progress for all the other groups. But the atheist, agnostic group is at the bottom of the totem pole still. That was 2 years ago, and there's been even change since then.
That's scary, apparently.
And it was asking questions like, who would you want your son or daughter to marry? And, of course, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense with the gay marriage thing as much. But they weren't necessarily endorsing it. But atheists were still at the bottom. And the myths and stereotypes, people were interviewed about atheists, and they're all prostitutes, they're all criminals, they're all, I mean, just
drug
crazy
users.
Myths.
Selfish.
That, like, they'd never met.
Arrogant.
When we interviewed Penny Edgell on our first Free Thought radio show, really briefly, and she said that she felt the real problem was that most of these people had never knowingly met a non-believer. And of course, Dan had that, came out of an evangelical background and was a preacher, and when he went through his transformation, purely intellectual, gradually throwing out the bathwater and finding there was no baby there, as he says, you had never met another, knowingly, never met another atheist. And that's amazing. I mean, you were 34 years old or something in Southern California. So I think it's terribly important for people to be open about their challenge of, you know, dogma and belief. And
people are frightened about it.
Right, but as it becomes more socially acceptable, we're going to find out a lot more people coming out of the closet. And that's eventually going to trickle down to some of the mega church goers.
Well, this would be a good time, for, in conclusion, for you to say something about your two books here.
Well, your book.
Oh, well, we have a few samples of our newspapers we got today, if anybody wants them, and you can always go to our website or phone. We'd be glad to send one. We have the November coming out Monday. And
I sold out of these books yesterday. I could have brought some more.
Dan was speaking to a group in Milwaukee, and this is the leftovers.
You can find this at Borders and Barnes & Noble.
But you can also buy it from FFRF for $15 postpaid, and Dan will autograph it. And it does have this great foreword by Richard Dawkins. Can I just read that one little bit that he talks about you? Because it is really funny.
It's underlined on the second page.
It's interesting what you chose for cover.
I didn't choose that.
Oh, yeah.
It's a good choice.
Yeah, I think it's clever. This is what Richard Dawkins said about Dan. The most eloquent witness of internal delusion that I know, a triumphantly smiling refugee from the zany cerebral world of American fundamentalist Protestantism, is Dan Barker. Dan was not just a preacher, he was the kind of preacher that, quote, you would not want to sit next to on a bus, unquote. That's Dan's line. He was the kind of preacher who would march up to a perfect stranger in the street and ask if they were saved. The kind of doorstepper on whom you might be tempted to set the dogs. Dan knows deeply what it is like to be a wingnut, a faith head, a fully paid up nut job, an all singing, all glossolaling religious freak bat. He can take us simultaneously laughing and falling into that bat belfry world and even make us sympathize. So this is, and then I like the line that he talks about your mother. Where is that? After he came out on his atheism to his parents, he said, in his mother's case, it only took her a few weeks to conclude that religion is a bunch of baloney, and a little later she was able to add happily, I don't have to hate anymore. Wow. You know, they're very fundamentalists. So that's Dan's new hot off the press book. It's way up there on Amazon.com. Another one of those pre-thought books out there.
Annie Laurie has a book too. She has two books.
It's been around for a while. Woe to the Women, the Bible Tells Me So. It's about Bible sexism. And we have some other, a couple of free things. And Dan's music, Beware of Dogma, the title song.
We enjoyed listening to those on our long road trip last year.
That's me barking, did you know that?
Yeah.
Oops. I didn't drink that.
It's okay.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.